You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today, we'll be talking about the state of public transportation in Richmond, introduce you to the Art Deco Society of Virginia, and present the second in a two-part segment on the growing fight over the city's water rates. Here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The no parking controversy on West Broad Street is over. Signs that criminalize late-night parking on Broad Street between Pine and Boulevard will come down, according to the city's Department of Public Works. This ends a months-old conflict which saw local business owners, as well as the West Grace Street Association, up in arms over the police decision to begin ticketing automobiles between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., a move which many saw as the police targeting patrons of the Camo Nightclub and the Firehouse Theater. Last week, the police announced a new no-parking time of 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., angering the neighborhood association and local businesses who wanted the signs removed entirely. This set off a stinging rebuke from West Grace Association President Elise Arenheimer, who told City Councilman Charles Samuels in an email exchange obtained by Open Source RVA that the parking controversy was the most colossal, shameful, unbelievable, stupid, and disrespectful solution to a neighborhood problem that she had ever encountered. The teen pregnancy rate in Richmond has dropped 30%, according to the city's adolescent health program. Good news considering that 5 years ago, Richmond had three times the state average of pregnant teen women aged 15 through 17. According to the Virginia Department of Health, there were more than 900 teen pregnancies in Richmond City in 2008, that number dropped to 600 plus in 2010. But is this a victory for the city? That same year, the Center for Disease Control's nationwide statistics show that the last time so few teens gave birth was the end of World War II. It's worth noting that free walk-in services for teens are offered from 1 to 5 p.m. every Thursday at the Richmond City Health District location at 400 East Carey Street. Teens must show up before 4 p.m. to be seen. Yesterday, Hopewell Circuit Judge W. Allen Sherritt ruled for the release of former Marine Brandon Raub from involuntary commitment in a psychiatric ward. Last Thursday, the FBI, Secret Service, and Chesterfield Police Department showed up at the Chesterfield County home of Raub, a 26-year-old veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan, saying they wanted to talk to him about his Facebook post. Raub was handcuffed and taken into custody by law enforcement officials who did not officially charge him or offer an explanation. According to the Rutherford Institute, the Charlottesville-based civil liberties group that represented him. The vet was held against his will at John Randolph Medical Center after a brief evaluation due to the alleged concern that his Facebook posts were terrorist in nature. The posts in question were a combination of song lyrics, conspiracy theories, political speech, and virtual card games. The most supposedly troubling content, Raub asserts, was taken out of context. A Monday hearing determined that Raub was to be held involuntarily in another psychiatric facility for 30 days, so Thursday's ruling was something of a surprise. Judge Sherritt dismissed the petition for Raub's commitment as so devoid of any factual allegations that it could not be reasonably expected to give rise to a case or controversy. The much-anticipated grassroots event Happily Natural Day goes on this weekend. The festival celebrates Black culture and ethnic pride with an emphasis on social change and holistic health and wellness. Founder Daron Chavis states on the website that the day is meant to go beyond hair and that during Happily Natural Day, one is immersed in the myriad of ways that people of African and indigenous descent experience authentic and sustainable lifestyles in a modern contemporary context. Events will span from today, August 24th, to Sunday, August 26th. Check out the Facebook page or happilynaturalday.com for more information.
The Brookings Institute, in a study of American cities, recently ranked Richmond in the bottom 10% when it came to access to jobs by public transportation. According to their findings, only 25% of Richmond's available job opportunities are accessible if you don't have an automobile. Reverend Ben Campbell thinks this is outrageous. The pastoral director at Richmond Hill and the author of Richmond's Unhealed History recently wrote a back page essay for Style Weekly on how the Richmond region could address the problem of public transportation. Reverend Campbell is here with us today to talk about his proposal to, as he says, make Metro Richmond one of the nation's top cities when it comes to public transportation. Welcome, Reverend Campbell, to Open Source RVA.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Don.
What exactly did the Brookings Institute find? What is the problem with Richmond's public transportation?
Well, of course, all of us knew it. The fascinating things about this kind of research is it just writes down in statistical fashion what anybody can see, which is that Richmond has very poor access to jobs by public transportation. What it did was to study 100 largest cities in America, and Metropolitan Richmond, of course, these are all metropolitan cities. Metropolitan Richmond ranks 92nd among the 100 largest cities in America, not exactly world class, for access to jobs by public transportation. Do you want me to tell you how they got it?
Well, yeah, please.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So here's what they did. They looked at the job sites and whether public transportation went by that site, and they looked at where people lived and whether the public transportation went by there. They looked for public transportation within 3/4 of a mile of those. So it's really very generous to a public transportation system if you can imagine walking 3/4 of a mile on both ends of a bus ride.
Right.
They looked at the period at the morning rush hour, which is the height of most public transportation systems, and they asked themselves, can a person get to a job within 90 minutes during rush hour on public transportation, walking as much as 3/4 of a mile on either end? And they found that Richmond was 92nd in the country for access to jobs, which is pretty pitiful.
Well, you write in your essay for Style that that this region's industries and population are close to 4 major corridors that intersect in the center of the city. Would seem like looking at that, it might be sort of a simple thing to fix.
It is a simple thing to fix. I mean, a basic rule is if there are 8 lanes of traffic there probably ought to be public transportation along it. It's fairly simple to see. And I'd say in most cities in the world, and even in the United States, that policy is followed. And it was followed in Richmond until about 1955.
Well, first of all, let's identify these routes. It's Route 1.
That would be Route 1, north and south. You could go, and what we're looking at here initially is essentially Richmond within the Beltway, which is 288, 295. So Route 1, north and south, Route 360, east and west, which is Mechanicsville, and what is that, Hull Street? What's 360? Then Midlothian Turnpike, 60, east and west, because east goes over to the airport. And then you're talking about
250.
250, which is Broad Street out to Short Pump.
And you say in your essay that adding bus lines or light rail in these corridors would be a huge help. What kind of an increased bus fleet are we talking about, or an increased vehicle?
Well, you can do it several ways. I mean, obviously, what you really want to do in any public transportation, and what Richmond did till 1955 or so, is to create a public transportation system that is rapid, that can compete with the automobile, and that will attract middle-class riders as well as low-income riders.
Right.
If you put what some of the top cities in America are doing today, which is bus rapid transit, which is a mix between bus and light rail on these routes, and run it every half hour on average for a 16-hour day, you basically cover the metropolitan city. You could put buses on those routes tomorrow. It's not difficult, and we would probably have to buy a few or rent a few, but we could do that, and we could have a pretty full-scale system beginning to ramp up.
I guess I'm trying to get in my mind what this might cost and what it might entail to actually do this, to think, well, maybe it's so big a task that it's prohibitive, that this is why we don't already do this.
Well, it's actually relatively minor in terms of cost. It just depends on whether you want to do it. The Richmond Regional Planning District Commission in 2008 did a study of public transportation in metropolitan Richmond and actually has a pretty good outline of it. They reckoned that you could have virtually full service with at least one light rail line and a couple of bus rapid transit lines for an annual operating cost of about $70 million a year. Now, that's really relatively low. One of the things in public transportation funding is that it is the operating cost that you pay, whereas in automobile funding, the public money mm-hmm. pays the construction cost and the maintenance cost of the highways. And Virginia, in its wisdom, makes it much harder to get operating money, which is actually much more efficient and much cheaper than it does to get capital money.
Well, you make the point that the jobs in the region used to be in the city, but now they're in the counties. Richmond residents without a car just can't get to those jobs.
Yes, what you've got about it is about 75% of your jobs outside the city lines right mm-hmm. now. So when the city lines are treated as the economic lines for low-income people, that is people who might have to use public transportation, but not for middle and upper middle-income people who can drive back and forth across them not even knowing they're there, what you effectively do is to create segregation by transportation, at least along economic lines. And because economic segregation in Virginia was basically a racial system mm-hmm. Through 1970, right. when we began to abolish it, it means it's also racially segregated.
Well, I want to get into that, but first, you said in the Style Weekly essay that your proposal would have a multi-jurisdictional authority overseeing it that would have split oversight between the city and neighboring counties. Is that right?
Most metropolitan public transportation systems, for example, in Tidewater, mm-hmm. but all over the country, run with what they call a multi-jurisdictional right. authority, like the RMA, which is a mm-hmm. multi-jurisdictional authority. And obviously, you would want to create one to do this, and you would want to give it, if possible, a dedicated source of revenue. Mm-hmm. And those two things are what make public transportation possible. Just to give you an idea of the numbers here, about 125,000 jobs in metropolitan Richmond are accessible by public transportation. If you simply extend these basic public transportation corridors along these four corridors we talk, you immediately double the number of jobs accessible to about 50 or 51% of the jobs in metropolitan Richmond. It now becomes 250,000. If you assure yourself of relatively simple connector lines to these trunk lines, mm-hmm. like running along Parham Road from West Broad Street over to Chamberlain Avenue over toward J. Sergeant Reynolds, mm-hmm. Or Courthouse Road in Chesterfield County, you get up to 75% or 80% of the jobs accessible. Mm-hmm. It really is an immediate opportunity. One of the reasons being that in Richmond, we still have these basic corridors which handle most of the transportation.
Well, one aspect of your proposal that's kind of controversial, to pay for this better system, you propose raising the sales tax.
I don't really care how you pay for it. You just have to pay for it. But let me just say that paying for transportation is something you do if you want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And in between 19...
If it's a priority.
Yeah. If you want to do it, you do it. You figure it out. A half cent on the sales tax mm-hmm. In the four jurisdictions of metropolitan Richmond that are hefty ones, Richmond, mm-hmm. Henrico, Chesterfield, and Hanover, a half cent would more than cover the operating cost of a public transportation system. It would be done. Mm-hmm. And the fares would be $1.50, relatively reasonable. You would have all these incredible economic advantages, not only to the individuals using it, but long-term to the metropolitan city, probably be one of the most efficient and effective expenditures of public money that we could make. Chesterfield just spent $20 million to get an interchange built on I-295 mm-hmm. in order to facilitate 1,500 jobs at Amazon. That's a pretty big hunk of money for a very small, relatively small piece of the economic pie. People pay for this all the time, mm-hmm. and we need to find a way to do it. So it actually is not a whole lot of money, but a lot of benefit.
Well, let's get to the counties in a second. You're a member of the Mayor's Anti-Poverty Commission, correct?
Correct.
Where do you think the mayor would stand on something like a sales tax increase? Would he back that?
No public politician is going to back a sales to any kind of tax increase immediately. What happens in a situation like this, my general feeling about metropolitan Richmond is that if Patrick Henry stood up and said, give me liberty and give me death today in this metropolitan city, they turn their back, walk away, and let death happen.
Nutcase.
There is no energy to do the right thing. We act right. like we are going to be done to till the end of time. And when that's to our advantage, was never really to our advantage. But we're very what makes someone create a revenue source is a desire for a program, mm-hmm. not a desire to create a revenue source.
Well, so I guess the big question,
if the public were to demand and seek to really make this place function as a single economic entity, so that it would actually be competitive with some of the other cities around, mm-hmm. Like Charlotte, who stole all our banks in the last 20 years,
right.
because they'd gotten themselves together, because mm-hmm. Charlotte and Mecklenburg had merged. Mm-hmm. They were able to be an economic engine in the last 25 or 30 years and actually just really took off in the South.
This can't have escaped our movers and shakers. Why, I guess this is the big question, why isn't this a bigger priority, not just with the governments, but also with some of the business leaders?
We are trapped in a negative spirit, which has been going on in Richmond for at least 200 years. It comes from the time of the American Revolution, at least, when we had a revolution for 50% of our population and inaugurated a slave republic for the other 50%. Hmm. That level of hypocrisy tends to be demoralizing. How it is we've become this way, I don't know. But we are generally, in terms of our economic development and our metropolitan work, we are our worst selves most of the time, and mm-hmm. it does not work. We do not do well, and we are extremely inefficient. We have 1 million people and 8 identical governments. You know, if we were a bank, we would have consolidated and moved to Charlotte.
Well, we seem to be hitting the brick wall, the same brick wall on so many types of issues, and that... And the overriding issue is regional cooperation. It seems to be, when it comes to building a ballpark or finding funding for amenities, it always seems to be that the counties and the city simply can't get it together. Why do you think that is?
Oh, perhaps I should ask you why you think it is. I mean, I think it is extremely painful. You watch, it's like the crabs in the barrel thing. You watch people just destroy themselves, and mm-hmm. you watch a community, a metropolitan community, destroy itself because of the inability to function as a whole. What you have to do in this society, there's nobody who speaks for the whole. What you have to do in this society is to raise the kind of movement that actually wants something to happen. What's interesting in the public transportation proposal is that it is a metropolitan solution that in fact has genuine economic benefit, addresses long-term issues of race and class, and does not require the joining together of the jurisdictions at this point in time. You're not doing consolidation of counties and city. What you're doing, however, is something of real economic import, and mm-hmm. the economic import of this is immense. The ability to say to any firm or employer attempting to locate in metropolitan Richmond that you have access by public transportation to 80% of our workforce mm-hmm. if you come here. We really don't care where you are in this area. We can put you in access mm-hmm. to the workforce. That's an immense appeal. And if you talk to people seriously who've talked to locators throughout the country, you'll find out that this is a real thing. It also permits the gradual growth of efficiency in transportation in general. Mm-hmm. The building of roads is really quite expensive. The beltway around Richmond cost over $1 billion of public money between 1980 and 2000. It's a far overbuilt road. It will not be fully used mm-hmm. for the next 20 years, I would say. And frankly, if you talk to people who say, well, I see buses going down the road and a lot of them are half empty, I just want to say, go out mm-hmm. and look at 295 and 288 if you want to see public transportation that's empty and is overbuilt.
Right, right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the factors behind this. In your essay, you kind of blamed racism for some of this. ingrained racism. Can you speak a little bit more about that and how that could be a factor where maybe some of the city residents are being isolated?
The primary issue of racism in metropolitan Richmond is not personal attitude toward a person of another color. Most people I know, and I know a whole lot of people from very conservative to very liberal and in all races, most people I know have done some personal work to try to address the issue of racial prejudice within their own spirit. Most people try to have friends or persons they know across racial lines. There is a lot of work that has gone on in that way in the South and in metropolitan Richmond. It really has. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of good relationships across racial lines. But what we have here is a situation that was actually created by the General Assembly of Virginia in the period from 1950 to 1970 when their number one issue was how to preserve racial segregation. Mm-hmm. And they created a situation by law and by jurisdictional line, which made it virtually impossible to function as a single city when it comes to issues of economics. Mm-hmm. I can go into how that happened. It was quite remarkable. Until 1950, Richmond had an incredible public transportation system that almost everybody rode. Incidentally, black mm-hmm. people were at the back of the bus and white people were at the front of the bus.
Right,
but there
right.
was a bus covering any part of town, streetcars down on Broad Street. Mm-hmm. Look on the web and see VCU's great postcard collection of the streetcars on Broad Street. Mm-hmm. It's really quite remarkable. And everybody knew we had a top public transportation system. But between 1950 and 1970, the leaders of Richmond basically destroyed every black neighborhood in the center city. Mm-hmm. That's one of the most devastating pieces of quote, urban renewal done.
And that's something that you wrote about in your book,
yeah,
Richmond's Unsung
right.
History. That was a kind of an unflinching look at race relations.
It's painful. I mean, they really did destroy. And what happened then is, and they destroyed it and created roads, industrial space, and some very condensed public housing. Mm-hmm. The people who could move out of that area when their neighborhood was ruined, moved to the near white suburbs, which were still within the city lines because Richmond had annexed each time it grew, it mm-hmm. grew larger. Those white folks who were living in those neighborhoods, because we did this kind of racial bumping, blockbusting thing, the white folks moved across the jurisdictional lines. So, for example, between 1950 and 1960, Henrico gained 100,000 people, almost all white citizens moving across the lines. And that began to happen in Chesterfield as well. At that point, the public transportation system did not move across the line. It simply stayed at the boundary of Richmond and Henrico, Richmond and Chesterfield, because the state of Virginia, now mind you, they were building these interstate highways. Mm-hmm. They were building the Richmond-Petersburg Turnpike right through Jackson Ward. They were building the Downtown Expressway right. in 1970. And they were building Chamberlain Avenue, some other I-95, some other major highways. So you could go back and forth on a car. But the state of Virginia says that any locality has the basic right to decide whether or not it has public transportation. So all of a sudden, it was up to the Henrico County Board, mm-hmm. Newly composed of persons who had basically fled the inner city, mm-hmm. To decide whether or not the buses were going to go out to Henrico.
That
was created by the General Assembly. General Assembly didn't think about anything but race from 1950 to 1970. Mm-hmm.
The impetus for pretty much every decision.
It was in every conversation. It was incredible. And mm-hmm. I knew people in the General Assembly at that time. Mm-hmm. Anybody who really is being honest will tell you that's what they were doing. So they set it up this way. Mm-hmm. Now it's this way and nobody knows why. There's
right.
no logic to it. If we were one economic entity, if Metro Richmond were a single municipality, obviously our public transportation would go out to the beltways and would have mm-hmm. done so 20 years ago. So it's an obvious thing to do. But we're caught in this kind of pygmy-like behavior mm-hmm. That really is not as good as we are. And we act as if it were a real conversation about whether you ought to have public transportation to your major jobs and on your major highways. And it puts us in 92nd position in the country. The issue of public transportation, like any Richmond is here because of a river. So the transportation preceded development. Route 288 and 295 were built to spur development. It will take 20 or 30 years for them to reach their full potential as highways. If you put a proper public transportation line in, it takes a while for the thing to fill up and to do what it's supposed to do. People reorient their employment situation, they reorient their residential situation, they change what they do. So it'll take us a while. But the nice thing about Richmond is that it's so simple.
Well, final question. You know, I've always been impressed by the city's bus service, and I've used it. I use it a lot. How much of a proposal would be just educating the public on the importance of public transportation? Do people even know that there are options out there? That there could be options out there?
I don't know. I mean, I will say the city's bus service in the Brookings Institution report, this is a very interesting little thing. The city of Richmond treated by itself is number one in the country in access to jobs and public transportation within its boundary.
Oh, the city.
They looked at that.
Okay.
The problem is the jobs aren't here.
Right.
So, but there's, you know, now people complain about the bus service, and there are some definitely, it's not as good as people would like, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's not used as much as it
would. Well, yeah, if anything, it seems to be in some routes, it's underused.
Right. Yeah, it is, because you basically, people have to get somewhere else. You can only use it if you can get to where you need to get. One other piece of data that's important to know, the city of Richmond, that is this central jurisdiction of 200,000 people, City of Richmond has over 60% of its households have no car or one car. In fact, 20% of the households in the city have no car whatsoever. So, if there's to be any employment for those folks, it has to be public transportation. I work with a group of high school students at one of the inner city high schools in Richmond, and I asked these students who are sophomores, juniors, and seniors, how many of them had driver's licenses? Out of 24 students, how many do you think had driver's licenses?
Half?
One.
Whoa.
Huh? No car to drive.
Yeah.
And some other things blocking it, including cost of driver's ed, which is now $200 a person.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because Richmond's school budget has been cut by the state every year for the last 20 years, so you just find a new thing to cut every year. That's one thing that got cut. So if you have only one car in a household, a teenager usually can't get access to a car. And if you have none, nobody has access. So you can figure, if you want to have your young people employed, if you don't have public transportation, basically you pretty well assure they cannot get anywhere except to jobs there that are on the bus line.
And I'm guessing we'd rather have them employed than walking around the streets aimless and wandering, right?
Really? We say we would, but we don't do the basic work. You know, I can't think of any metropolitan city in the country where you'd actually have to argue for public transportation. And like I said, what happened to the spirit of these folks that brought about the American Revolution and that decided we were going to be a dynamic, powerful society? And what happened to all of us Christian folks? You know, I'm an Episcopal priest who we have more people going to church in this metropolitan city than almost any city of comparable size in America. What happened?
Where's the energy here? Right.
To me, it's an exciting possibility. I think we could be proud of ourselves. And it is true that if we simply did a simple skeletal trunk line service, we would be among the top 10 cities in America.
I'm Don Harrison, and you're listening to Open Source RVA on 97.3 LPFM WRIR. And I've been talking with Reverend Ben Campbell, the author of Richmond's Unhealed History. He's been talking about the problems with public transportation in the Richmond region and the possible solution. His recent back page essay on the subject can be found at styleweekly.com. Thanks for being with us today, Reverend Campbell.
Thank you, Don.
We're back with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and we're talking water and how much city residents pay for it. Last week we had Charles Poole from the Sierra Club Falls of the James Group to come in and talk with us about a new petition being circulated to lower Richmond's water rates, and you can find that at the Falls of the James website at virginia.sierraclub.org/FOJ. This week, for part two of our journey into water, we're pleased to welcome Bob Stidell. He's the director of the Department of Public Utilities, City of Richmond, and he's going to talk with us about the city's stance on this rising controversy. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Stidell.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
$49.40, that's what everyone pays in the city before they see a drop of water. And last week, I was issued a challenge by the Sierra Club Falls of the James Group. They asked me if I could find any city in the nation that had a water hookup fee as high as Richmond's, and I tried and I could not. Can you cite any city in the nation that has water service charges as high as ours?
I don't know. I don't look for what other people do. Each city and each utility is so different. We just don't go out and compare ourselves against other people. Mm-hmm. There's a report that's put out every year on water and sewer rates in the Commonwealth, which is just a way of looking at how rates compare. And the rate you talked about was the residential rate. That's
yes.
Different than the other classes of customers. But as I understand the conversation right now, it really is a discussion about what is the service level that the city charges for both water and for wastewater, and then we have a volumetric charge on top of that. And what is the balance between those two charges, and how should they change? Mm-hmm. We evaluate this every 5 years, and we are just, as we start, in the process of evaluating it for the next 5 years. When we went before City Council last March and went over where we were with the budgets and with the rates, we wrapped up what we had accomplished in the last five mm-hmm. years. We had done three things. We had changed the winter quarter that we charged for the wastewater, so that benefited all the citizens in the city. We had changed the rate of equity between all the classes. We used to have a tier system. We used to charge less for more water that you bought. Hmm. That made sense back in the 60s and 70s when you were trying to attract businesses to come to the city and locate here. Mm-hmm. So you tried to find ways to incentivize them. This day and age, that doesn't make any sense anymore. So for 5 years, we've been raising the rates on the industrial and commercial. We raised it 60% during a recession. Hmm. And that's a lot of money to ask people to spend and keep their businesses here in town, but they've been good to support us. We've lost a couple. We lost Cumanda. We lost Interbake Foods. But again, for the most part, the business community in Richmond understands the value of water, mm-hmm. and they supported that. But we've eliminated that now. Everybody pays the same rate. Doesn't matter if you buy 1 gallon from us or 1,000 gallons from us, you pay the same rate. And then the third thing that we wanted to accomplish was to put a conservation rate in when we had to go into voluntary conservation like they're doing down in Chesterfield right now. Mm-hmm. We're not doing it in the city. But we put in a new rate that said, you know, if we really need to conserve water, that's an inclining tier rate, and we actually charge more. That was what we did in the last 5 years. Now, looking forward in the 5 years, the conversation that was actually begun back in last March when we were before City Council, the mayor challenged us to find new ways going forward to find rates that were affordable for low-income citizens.
Right. Would you agree that $49.40 rate is very, very high?
I think it's. I don't want to say it's very high. I don't think we even pay for the full cost of water yet in the city of Richmond, but it is a high rate for people who are on a fixed income or a low income. Any rate like gasoline, mm-hmm. utilities, mm-hmm. power, you know, that's going to be, because we make different amounts of money, it's going to impact folks that make less money different. So, yes, it is a significant amount of money to ask for people to spend. In fact, we watch that very carefully. It's about 1.25% of the median household income for a citizen in the city of Richmond, and that's a lot of money. The affordability cap, when you read what the EPA says they like people to charge throughout the United States, is 2%. We think that's way too high. Mm-hmm. The $49 covers very important things. Everybody in the city uses the fire hydrants, so that's part of that base charge. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the city uses the pipes that carry not only the drinking water, but the fire water. Everybody pays for that. That's part of the base charge. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses the treatment plants. Everybody mm-hmm. uses the flood wall, which is part right. of that charge. Everybody uses the canal system, which we pay for that charge. Everybody uses the customer call center that we operate for the city of Richmond, which is part of that charge. Hmm. So all these things that everybody pays for, it doesn't matter if you're a low-income person, medium-income, mm-hmm. that's what we put into the base charge. And you know, when we look at that charge going forward, we're going to say, okay, let's take another look at it. Should we lower that base charge and change that volumetric charge? How mm-hmm. should we do that? You know, in the natural gas program, because natural gas is a lot of people's money during the winter, we have something called the MetroCare program where we help low-income people to be able to pay for their energy. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should be doing that with water, too. Maybe we should right. establish that same kind of project. Same kind of program.
Because when people see this charge and they look and see that Henrico only charges $16.27 for a water hookup, or Chesterfield only charges $22, and they see that Richmond is more than double that,
right.
That's got to be a little alarming to people, particularly people, like you say, on fixed incomes.
Sure. Now, this is not for hookup. Remember, hookup charge is different. This is the service
this
charge.
This is a service. I'm sorry, the service charge. Right.
But then again, think of the differences. The water plant and the treatment plant in Richmond were built decades before the plants were built in Chesterfield and mm-hmm. Henrico. Newer mm-hmm. plants are easier to maintain. Also, again, remember, Chesterfield doesn't have a flood wall. The city of Richmond does, so we mm-hmm. have to pay for that. Chesterfield mm-hmm. doesn't have canals. There are other charges that we wind up paying in the city of Richmond, and then the one that everybody understands is the combined sewer system. Remember, the city of Richmond was mm-hmm. built way back in, 400 years ago. The people who had my job understood that the best way to keep people from being sick was to take sewage, get it out of the city as fast as mm-hmm. possible, and dump it into the nearest river. That wasn't, we look at it now and say that was crazy, but back in those days, they were just trying to keep disease to a minimum. Mm-hmm. So we have a large combined sewer system over a third of the city, which actually takes up about a third of that base charge on the wastewater side. So we have things that we pay for that the counties don't pay for that makes it a challenge on our part to communicate what they're paying for and why it's worth it.
Well, help me out, because I understand that we actually sell water to Henrico and Chesterfield County. How is it that they're able to buy water from us and then sell it to their residents at such a lower cost?
Sure. Remember, we have wholesale contracts. We have three wholesale contracts for water, one for Hanover, one for Henrico, and one for Chesterfield. We also have wholesale contracts for wastewater with Goochland, Chesterfield, and Henrico. But these are wholesale costs. Mm-hmm. We basically charge them what they use of our system. In other words, whatever their allocated percentage is of the Richmond system that they use, we total that up all year long, and then we give them a bill. Mm-hmm. They also have their own water treatment plants that they buy their own water from. They can sell it. Plus, remember, they also have subdivisions and an expansion mm-hmm. where they can take the dollars that they get paid for the infrastructure that the developers put in, and they're able to use those dollars wisely for their citizens. The way they do their rates are different than ours. We don't have that kind of development. When you look at the fees that we charge for taps, ours are much, much less than the counties are, because we don't have that same kind of rate structure. Mm-hmm. We'll look at it again during the upcoming 5 years. Should we change that? But again, our type of development here in the city is different. We're redeveloping. We're renewing buildings. Mm-hmm. Out there, they're building in green fields. They're expanding sewers. There's just different ways that the counties can bring monies in and be able to offset what they have to charge their customers for, for the water and sewer that they use.
Well, some localities only charge according to what you use, and they don't really have a water service fee. And my old haunts, Norfolk only charges a dollar, and they appear to only charge you for the water that you use.
And many places will do that, but then you have to go back and see, are they taking part of the property tax and then applying that to the utility system mm-hmm. also? Mm-hmm. In Richmond, we don't do that. None of the property taxes go to the utilities. They're all enterprise funds. There's many different ways localities can use to decide how they want to fund their infrastructure and to fund their programs. And that's why it's difficult to actually compare one against the other.
Well, some are making it an economic justice issue, as you know. Mm-hmm. The Richmond NAACP recently issued a statement on which Richmond's water rates. I'd like just for you to comment on this. The statement read, typically low-income residents will not be filling swimming pools or sprinkling massive yards. These high minimum service charges force low-income residents to subsidize wealthy households that typically use the most water. Do you agree with him that Richmond's high water service charges are a burden?
I will say for low-income people, $47 a month is difficult to pay, just like their electric bill is, just like their natural gas bills.
$49.40.
Yeah, I truly agree with that statement. So again, we can look at how we balance those costs off. We can reduce that base charge, but again, mm-hmm. remember the things that all the citizens have to have. They have to have the fire hydrants, they have to have the water pipes, the mm-hmm. treatment plants. We got to make sure that we balance off where those costs are. Remember, the more that you buy when we increase that amount per CCF is going to translate back to our large employers also. Mm-hmm. They're going to pay more. They've already paid 60% more in the last 5 years, and that cost we will look at, and their
cost may go up too. So the pain is being spread around, is what you're
saying. The pain will be spread around, and we want to make sure that we don't disincentivize anybody. That's why I say I think looking at our current natural gas MetroCare program for water may be more important for low-income people that are struggling to pay their bills. Mm-hmm. That may be just one tool that we use when we come back and look at new rates. Another tool that we could use was something that's called lifeline rates. Just because I pay one rate doesn't mean that somebody who needs a lifeline even pays a lower rate. It's a different rate than what I pay for the water that mm-hmm. I use. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different ways that I think we need to reach out to and find ways that our citizens can get the service that they provide. Because remember, every morning you get water delivered to your house and you get sewage taken away from your toilet. You don't have to do anything. It shows up. Right. You don't have to. Even during the storms, we deliver. And we want everybody to have that service. Sanitation mm-hmm. was one of the top 10 accomplishments of the last century for public health. And we want to make sure that we're providing that service at the best available cost we possibly can. So, yes, for those that are most impacted on the lower end of our income scales, we want to find ways to make it more affordable for them.
The NAACP also followed up and said that, this is a quote, Richmond's water sewage utility is even running a very large profit and pays millions of dollars into the city's general fund. This is the most regressive means possible to fund Richmond's general expenses, an outrageous burdensome minimum service charge on a necessity no one can do without. Is it true that we're actually making a huge, maybe $12 million profit off of these water rates and not really putting it back into infrastructure?
Again, I'm not going to say that's the statement. What I'll tell you is that the City of Richmond's utility departments, and this is gas, water, and sewer, mm-hmm. We pay taxes just like we were a private entity. Say we were the Virginia American Water Company that provides water to Hopewell, Virginia.
Right.
They pay taxes to the City of Hopewell. It is appropriate and allowable that mm-hmm. an enterprise fund like we have can be charged those same taxes for real estate, personal property, mm-hmm. dividend mm-hmm. payments, and that can be returned to the general fund in the form of what's called payment in lieu of taxes. It's not really profit. It is, again, a payment mm-hmm. that we make from the monies that the customers pay, but
right.
that would be our tax payment if we were a private industry. And yes, those are significant dollars that go back to the general fund, but there's significant dollars that go back to the general fund for schools and for
sure.
police and for fire.
Well, yeah, I've heard the theory that this water service charge is actually an offset that helps the city pay for these services. So that's, you're basically saying that.
Well, no. Remember the way we structure the rate, the service charge and the volumetric charge are all meant to come together and meet the revenue needs that we need to operate all of the utilities, mm-hmm. plus pay all of our payments, which include the pilot payments. So
right.
it's not a direct one-for-one. But again, when we structure a rate, we start out by estimating how much revenue are we going to need to pay all of our bills
mm-hmm.
for the gas that we buy, for the chemicals that we buy, for the electricity we consume, as well as our pilot payments and to pay our staff and to be able to pay all the bills we do. And then we build the rates from that. And that's where it gets allocated back mm-hmm. and forth between the service charge and the volumetric charge. Again, going forward, when we look at how we change that service charge and the base charge, it still has to total up to the total revenue. And right now, that total revenue does include the payment in lieu of taxes that we pay to the city's general fund. It's in the city's code that we are required to pay it, and in the city's charter that says when I present a budget to the mayor, mm-hmm. I have to present him a balanced budget based upon everything that I am told in code I have to be able to recover.
Yeah, that actually reads that that you have to break even?
We have to have a break even budget, correct? We cannot right. run either in the red or in the black at the end of the year. We need to balance.
Well, you just said something I wanted to ask you about. Richmond actually owns its own sewer and water utility. Shouldn't that help us keep our costs down, the fact that we're not being serviced by another entity that we actually own?
Sure. And that cost does keep it down. In other words, we're not sending pilot payments to investment bankers who, mm-hmm. who may have owned it. We keep the money in the city. It may not be always in utilities, but it can go for the good mm-hmm. of the general fund.
But there's also the fact that because the city owns it, there's no oversight of the rates by the State Corporation Commission.
And that's very true. Local governments are allowed to set their own rate, whereas a private would be set by the State Corporation Commission. When we do rates, we actually present a package to the administration as if we were presenting it to the State Corporation Commission. The State mm-hmm. Corporation Commission has very good analysts that look at rates from Dominion Power or from Virginia American Water Company. We try to present that same kind of package, and City Council has staff that looks at that package. We ask them to be mm-hmm. like our SEC analyst yeah. to look at that and ask all those questions throughout the budget period mm-hmm. and the budget process so we can continually make refinements throughout that process. But no, we don't report up to the State Corporation Commission. No local government unit does.
You knew where I was going with that. Does the city overcharge its citizens on this because they can? I guess is the question.
No, again, when we go to budget and when we present it, every category is put out there. We have the O&M categories mm-hmm. and the CIP categories, and we go through every one as to why we're paying that money and why it's going mm-hmm. out. Mm-hmm. If we were overcharging, we would expect council staff to push back on us big time and say that in their analysis of the budget, because remember, we propose the budget. Right. Council looks at it, and they're the ones that are going to approve it, so they're not going to approve it till they have all their questions answered. We would expect them to ask us those questions and make us prove up mm-hmm. every reason why we're spending money. We've decreased our operations and maintenance budget year after year because we're able to get some efficiencies in there. Mm-hmm. Where we're spending the most money is our capital improvement budget, the big stuff that we're doing. Some of the capital work we're doing now is deferred maintenance from the 90s that we didn't do. Some of the capital work we're doing now is new regulations. As Virginians, we decided we wanted cleaner water. We wanted less pollutants in our drinking water. We wanted all this done. A price comes with that. We're just finishing a project at the wastewater treatment plant that's going to run about $120 million so we can take more nitrogen and phosphorus out of that plant for a healthier James River. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not going to drink that water because it's going to go out of the wastewater plant, which is down by the I-95 bridge, and it's going to go out towards the folks that live in Hopewell. Somebody always lives downstream, so mm-hmm. what we're doing mm-hmm. is we're helping the people downstream. We hope the people upstream from us have that same ethic in Lynchburg and in Charlottesville. So the serious dollars we're spending right now are for the main capital improvements, the underground infrastructure that needs to be renewed. Our average pipe age is about 65. I don't mm-hmm. think that's very old. I think 65 is young but you have to understand that we should be right around 50, 55, because when winter comes and we get one of those cold winters that we have, you remember a couple of years ago, we kept having all those water main breaks. Well, mm-hmm. that's because of the age of the, and that was all 2-3-inch pipe. Mm-hmm. The age of that pipe is of such that we need to replace it.
But some of the cities that where I've seen the water service charges are, like, for instance, New York City, their charge is only 12, something like $12.90. You'd think that they would have an antiquated water system as well. How are they able to get around that and we're not?
Well, nationwide, the water infrastructure gap is over $300 billion. Everybody's got this problem. The New York is a good example of where they have many, many customers are able to spread that cost out over many, many more customers. Mm-hmm. But I would also say that I think New York's a good example of how they have continually made investments over the decades. I think they're one community that has stayed ahead of what I always call the credit card debt is due because we haven't made any payments on it. Right. I think, and I have good colleagues in Atlanta. If you look at Atlanta, they're the ones that are in trouble. They did not make any investments in their sewer system, and they're the ones that are paying $100 a month for their sewer system for their citizens because they had to raise the money. Mm-hmm. There's good examples and there's bad examples. I think Richmond has done a much better job in the recent decade that we have been investing in what we should be properly investing in.
Right, and Atlanta's their water service fee is $13.12.
That's on their water side, but remember on the wastewater side is a different
charge, yeah.
And that's the one that's. And again, you have to look back and forth. Some boroughs in New York don't own their own water system; they're private water system.
Okay.
So that makes a difference is how their rates are structured. That's why it's difficult to go in and look at these, look at a comparison until you really go in and look. For instance, we use in the city of Richmond high rate filtration for our water plant. Some places use ozone and they use membrane filters. These are different ways of treating the water, but there's different costs that are associated with them. We disinfect our water with chemicals. Some people disinfect their water with ultraviolet light. Again, it depends very much how young or how old the treatment plant is and how well it's been maintained over the years.
You're with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM, WRIR. My name is Don Harrison, and we're talking to Bob Stidell of Richmond's Department of Utilities about Richmond's water rates. The city recently announced that it's hired a consultant at a cost of $200,000 to study the city's water rates. What is he supposed to be studying?
Well, what we are doing, remember, there's four fee-based utilities in the Department of Public Utilities, gas, water, stormwater, and wastewater. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the staff to do this once every 5 years study. So every 5 years I bring in help for us to get. Mm-hmm. So what we are doing, and there are city staff and then the group, and I don't know if they've been procured 100% yet.
Right.
But we all work together. They can do a lot of the analysis along with us. Mm-hmm. I have to get this done between now and December when I have to present it to the administration. We've got a very short period of time. So what they'll do, they'll bring their economists. They do this nationwide. They'll give us the same kind of questions that you're asking. I have seen other places doing it this way. Why isn't the city of Richmond doing it? We want to recommend this to you. So we bring their expertise in. We bring our expertise as to what we need for revenue, and we all work together to get what we hope is the best five-year plan going forward that we finally. And also included with that is we have to consider what is our financial planning going to be because we will have to issue debt, and we will have to find ways to properly manage debt because of the financial considerations that we have to operate the utility. We want to make sure that we stay solid. The reason being is because when we know we have to borrow money, we have to have the right rating from the bond agencies. Mm-hmm. We were just recently confirmed as AA stable from Standard & Poor's, I think it was last week or week before, which is good, but we want to get to AAA like Chesterfield and Henrico have.
Sure.
Because that reduces the amount of money that we have to pay when we borrow, and then that way we can charge less to the citizens. It's not that we're going to borrow more, but we can charge less for that debt we have to incur.
Well, the last study that was done in 2007 by, I think it's Greeley and Hansen, identified Richmond's water rates as a problem and recommended a five-year phasing plan to reduce the monthly service fees. But instead of adopting anything like that, Richmond's service charge went up by $6. Speak to that, if you would, because that looks like sort of the typical Richmond thing where you hire the consultant and then you don't listen to what they say.
No, I have to clarify what that was.
What their recommendation was?
Well, no, the recommendation was to make the changes that I talked about earlier, and we've made every one of those changes. What we were saying is that we, by making those changes in rate of equity between the commercial, the industrial, and the governmental class, we could hold the residential rate the same. We wouldn't have to make any changes to it.
But it still went up.
But it still went up by 6%. The reason being is we couldn't forecast that the Great Economic Recession was going to happen in 2008. If we did, we would have been geniuses. Nobody in the world saw that.
Right.
So what we found is that during the 5 years of the recession, as Interbank Foods moved out, as Cumana moved out, as that changed, we were forced to raise the rates on the residents a little bit, 6% over the 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to do that, but Every year, we kept losing customers, but our costs didn't change because, again, you still have the infrastructure to maintain.
Right.
If we had not had a recession, we would not have ever had to have raised the rates to the residential. We were doing that for the commercial, the industrial, and the state-owned facilities. But the economy just really hurt us badly during this five-year period.
One really basic thing, and the folks at the Falls of the James Group kept bringing this up, the fact that the water service rates, the 4940, isn't listed or easily found on a resident's bill. Why wouldn't we be, all of these arguments that you have, they're perfectly valid, but why not just tell people what they're paying? Or is that something we could change?
And it is something you can change. I have the bill right here. We put a lot of information on this bill, and most of it is on the budget plan summary for most people who have natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
That's the information that we takes up a lot of room, and I think that's important because if you're on the budget payment plan, you want to know what your status of your account is every month. There's a lot of stuff that's on the bill. You see there's also the solid waste charge and the recycling charge. We can redo this and try to find ways to get more information on this, even make changes on the flip side to be able to provide more information to the customer.
Right.
I know not everybody has a computer, but you can go to our website and
we have a very
long section on rates, but I know that's not what you get in the mail when you get it. So what we have told everybody who's asked us the question, including city council and the mayor, when we put the new cost of service, and we'll find a way to redesign this to be able to provide more information for people so that they can see it on their bill and it makes more sense to them.
Well, there's an argument that having the water service charge is being high while the usage charge is actually quite low, from what I understand, actually hinders conservation of water. Can you speak to that? Does Richmond's current utilities plan actually encourage people to waste water?
Well, the answer to that is no. The remember, we have a conservation rate that when we go into voluntary and mandatory conservation, people will pay more money, and that's when the water is not available in the James River. That's already in effect. The comprehensive planning that the city of Richmond's done for the last three decades has been centered around we're going to have water supply and treatment so that people can decide whether they want to use it or not. For 30 years, we have been planning the infrastructure. We've been planning the treatment plant. We have been making sure that Richmond's water source actually comes up from Bath County in the Blue Ridge Mountains. That's where our water is stored all winter long up at Lake Mumaw.
Okay.
So what we do is we plan so that, again, people can decide to buy the water. Now, remember, that was planning decisions of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
That's when gas was cheap. Everything was cheap back in those days. So the water is available. People can choose to conserve. I choose to conserve at my house because I want to do it. It's part of what I want to do, but I'm not going to get paid for it. Now, if people want to get paid for conservation, again, we're going to look at a rate, whereas if we do an increasing tier on that, that will help to drive customers to save more and to conserve more. Right now, anybody can conserve if they want to, but again, that's just a decision they have to make. They're not going to get compensated for it in the rate. But again, we'll look at a rate that says if I buy 200 gallons instead of 50 gallons, I'm going to have to pay more. If I buy 600 gallons, I'll have to pay more. And again, that rate tends to incentivize what the customers think about when they think about buying water. Am I going to irrigate my yard? Mm-hmm. Am I going to use the power washer on the house? Mm-hmm. Am I going to fix the toilet so it doesn't leak and I get an extra 60 gallons on there? So those are things we can do. But again, remember, when we put that tier into place, then when the larger manufacturers and industries in town use more water, then they pay more for that water. Mm. And then we have to balance off where does it work best for them, for them to continue to be in the city of Richmond to be able to produce whatever it is they're producing.
Have you seen the petition that the Sierra Club Falls of the James group has is circulating online?
I have seen a copy of the text, yes.
Is there any sort of misinformation, you would say, in that, or do they pretty much spell it out pretty accurately?
They represent their position very well. The Sierra Club board has never called me or asked me any questions, so I haven't had an opportunity to talk to them. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that I think was an error, and I think they have changed it, is they kept saying that we don't charge a flat rate. We were charging less for the more water you use. And again, that changed as of July 1st of this year. Right. Everybody pays the same rate. And I believe that's been taken out of the petition at this point.
Yeah, I didn't see that in there.
So, but again, they are great advocates for their viewpoint, and they're doing what everybody should do. They're participating in the process. I know the mayor has at least two budget listening meetings scheduled this fall. And then once we really start into budget season in January and February and March, there will be many presentations and many communications on the budget. Everybody will have a chance to give their input on it, mm-hmm. Not only the folks that are doing the petition, but again, the industries and the commercial facilities that are in town need to come tell us what they think about the rates. I'm hoping to be able to go before the Chamber of Commerce here shortly to be able to get mm-hmm. their opinions and get their input back.
I would think that would be something very important to them. Consideration when people decide to move to the city.
And it's also important for, you know, when people look at the place where they want to live, they want to make sure that the infrastructure is well maintained and well taken care of. They want to make sure that. One important thing that we kind of sometimes forget is that the homeowners' rates that we pay are based on how well Chief Creasy runs the fire department, mm-hmm. but it's also based on how well the water system is maintained so that there's water available at the hydrants to be able to put out fires. So again, people just want to know that their community is a good place to live, it's well maintained, and it's professionally run, and we believe that that's the case here in the city of Richmond.
Well, great. Well, thanks for being with us today.
Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, it's Bob Stidell. He's the director of the Department of Public Utilities for the City of Richmond. And we've been talking water here on Open Source RVA.
Broadcast of Open Source RVA on WRIR is sponsored in part by Haberdasher Corporate Apparel, a locally owned, SWAM-certified, woman-owned business, providing uniforms, logo apparel, t-shirts, and promotional products to businesses, schools, and nonprofits in Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic region. More about Haberdasher can be found on Facebook and the web at haberdashercorporateapparel.com or by calling 804-878-7630. Thank you, Haberdasher.
The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool.
The style is instantly recognizable even if you've never heard of the term Art Deco. This glamorous form of retro-modernism became the predominant architectural style in the 20s and 30s, and its inspiration can still be felt, especially in Virginia, where examples of the sleek, symmetrical style can still be seen and enjoyed. Well, since its original heyday, Art Deco has also come to represent a fixed time in history, a time of flappers and bell hats and Manhattans spilled on tuxedos while a hot jazz band plays in the background. No one is keeping the playful spirit of Art Deco alive more successfully and fashionably than the Art Deco Society of Virginia. I'm joined by Olivia Lloyd, the founder and president of the Richmond-based club, and society board member Andy Nishida. And we're going to talk a bit about Art Deco, the retro design movement that keeps on giving. Welcome to Open Source RVA.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First of all, let's do a little remedial work for the people. What exactly is Art Deco?
Well, Art Deco is kind of a general term that kind of encompasses fashion, culture, a wide range of things that occurred during the 20s and 30s, architecture, fashion, music even. It's a lot of different things.
Who do we credit for coming up with Art Deco? I had always heard that it was originally the French. The French started some of the elements that we recognize today.
A lot of it did start in France, and you know, coincidentally, the term Art Deco wasn't really given to the period during that time. It was actually given to the period much later, I think actually in the 60s.
Huh.
You know, so at the time they didn't even call it, it wasn't the Art Deco period, you know, like we called it the Roaring Twenties. It wasn't actually called the Art Deco period. So that's actually a term that came later to define that time.
You're the president and founder of the Art Deco Society, Olivia. What got you interested in starting an organization devoted to it?
Well, I've always been sort of interested in all things vintage from a very, very young age. So just the design element of it, just the clean lines, and, you know, it's just so beautiful to me, really the architecture. But I also love the whole time period. I love mm-hmm. the 20s. I love the music behind it, the style, the fashion, you know, that whole, you know, the rise of the golden age of Hollywood, the glamour behind it. So it's just always appealed to me for, you know, a variety of reasons. And I was actually talking with Andy and his wife, Rita, on a trip one time, and we were talking about how Richmond really doesn't really have a society that embraces things like this, like the vintage lifestyle and things of that nature. And so this was something I had been thinking about and dreaming about for a while, and it just, you know, at the time it wasn't something I could do on my own. And after meeting with Andy and Rita, and we brought in our friend Bill Spiedel, and we all kind of joined forces and decided that, you know, this is something that Richmond really needs right now. We want to create a group where people who like the, you know, who enjoy deco and things, you know, all things vintage, can come and be a part of this wonderful, you know, come and be a part of it and meet people who are like, you know, mm-hmm. like them. And also that, you know, the added element of working on preserving the Art Deco buildings and structures and culture and society for future generations to, you know, enjoy and fall in love with just like I did. So
how many members do you currently have?
Well, it's steadily growing. I mean, our Facebook group alone has over 100 people in it. And, you know, we've only been around. I mean, we just had our first event.
A couple of months, really.
Yeah, we just had our very first event on August 12th. And that was, we had our Gatsby afternoon picnic in the park. And, you know, just by word of mouth, we had at least, like, I think 50-some people showed up.
Wow.
You know, and it was just a wonderful day. We all dressed up. We had a Victrola playing. We played croquet and just, you know, sat and had a picnic. And just, I met so many people. And it was really wonderful to see the, you know, the love and support from the community.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask what you all do at the Society. I assume that you weren't just looking at floor plans, and there was probably some cocktails involved. What was the Gatsby event about?
It was just about, you know, frivolity and having fun and kind of that throwback to, you know, in the 20s, on the weekends, people loaded up the car and they drove out to the countryside and had a picnic with their family and just, you know, enjoyed spending time with each other without cell phones and without television and, you know, just spending time outside and, you know, having conversations. And that's kind of what the picnic was about. It was about dressing up, having, you know, bringing your lunch and just meeting new people, having wonderful conversations, listening to some great music, perhaps playing a game of croquet. And, you know, just having a good time and kind of that, you know, in a relaxing day.
So the members have to check their egos and their cell phones at the door.
That's right.
you touched upon this, but when I think of Art Deco, I equate the term with the emergence of jazz music, mm-hmm. with the films of Busby Berkeley, mm-hmm. the words of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Talk about the larger cultural world that surrounds Art Deco.
Well, for me, I think a lot of it does, like Olivia, revolves around the music of the time. It was kind of an involvement of the traditional jazz that started in New Orleans and turned into this kind of hot jazz styles, which was basically forerunner to the swing era. But that hot jazz era was just something that I really gained a large interest in.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of in connection with that, my wife and I also are swing dancers, and through that we've also developed other dances or been in, or learned other dances, such as Charleston, which also mm-hmm. was done in that time. But the music for me is kind of the big draw. I mean, even before I learned to dance, I was really very much interested in just that style of music. It's just some kind of music that I just can't listen to without having a big smile on my face right. And just enjoying listening to and moving to it.
And this was also a time when young women started to feel empowered.
This was a huge time for women. This is when the new woman that mm-hmm. Who we know today started forming, and she had a hard time getting to where we are today. I mean, so it's also as far as from a I don't want to say a feminist perspective, but from that kind of angle, it was a very important time in our history.
Right, and one of the defining images of the era and of the fashion of that time was that of the flapper. Mm-hmm. Talk about her a little bit, because she's kind of an icon that represents the Art Deco period.
She is. She kind of represented not just frivolity, but women coming into their own, breaking out of society's molds and being themselves. We were in a very conservative Victorian time, and these women said, I don't want to wear corsets every day. I don't want to wear stockings. I don't want to wear a bustle. I want to cut my hair short. And, they did those things. Mm-hmm. And, they went out. There was lots of drinking and sex and wild parties. And, they didn't really care. It was just about having a good time. They were embracing that music and just, going out and having a wonderful time. And, for the most part, as they were shunned, but they were also made famous by F. Scott Fitzgerald in his books. So it just became, they really did become an icon of the era. Everybody wanted to know, who the flapper was, what they were doing. There was a writer one of the papers, her name, she went under the alias of Lipstick, and she went around in New York and talked about all the, hidden speakeasy clubs and what was going on there. And she was very popular. Everybody wanted to know what the flapper was doing, So it was a wild time.
Apparently the term, I always wondered where the term flapper came from. Apparently it came out of in reference to a young bird flapping its wings while learning to fly.
And I've learned it came from the women dancing from their Charleston. They were so wild with their arms flailing, they started calling them flappers.
Oh, I like that better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a design form, Art Deco was obviously influenced by Egyptian and African designs. I'm wondering if it became popular the first time around because during that period, the world started discovering itself through archaeology.
Hmm.
And trying to come to terms with other cultures and other ways of thinking.
That's interesting. It could be.
We would have just really come to grips with the pyramids and the mummies.
Right, and at that time, I mean, that was something, you would go to, if you went to, a wealthy person's mm-hmm. home, a lot of them had mummies in their house.
Right, right.
They were collecting that. It was very, prestigious.
I think the University of Richmond got one of its mummies because someone just donated their mummy.
Right. You would see these things in their houses, and then when they decided they didn't want them, they would burn them. And, it breaks my heart. But, that could be that a lot mm-hmm. of it's coming from that kind of influence because the Egyptians had those great clear, clean lines, lots of, circular design. So that's very well could be.
Well, talk about the design a little more. How can one tell if something is in the Art Deco style? What are some of the components that would make it recognizable?
Well, I think, like Olivia mentioned, clean lines. It's much more of a streamlined, minimalist type mm-hmm. elements that are in the design, not only in architecture, but in furniture and jewelry, all kinds of home furnishings. So anything that's kind of got those elements in it oftentimes could be classified as Art Deco. And also that includes advertising, graphic
right.
artwork of the time.
I was going to say, this wasn't just buildings. This was graphic design,
right.
automobiles, fashion.
Right.
In fact, I even saw one time a period radio that was in the Art
yes.
Deco
oh, there's so
mm-hmm.
many of
style.
Those.
Yes. So it pretty much got into just about everything that you would see in daily life.
Mm-hmm. You are with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM WRIR. I'm Don Harrison, and I'm talking with Olivia Lloyd and Andy Nishida. They're with the Art Deco Society of Virginia. What are some of the existing architectural examples that people can see around this area of Art Deco? What's out there for people to look at?
Well, my favorite building is the Model Tobacco Building, which is on Route 1, you know, as it turns into, I think, Jefferson Davis Highway. That's one of my all-time favorites. It's just has the sign, the design of it. I mean, everything just screams Art Deco. It's just one of my absolute favorites. I also really love the Henrico Theater on 9 Mile Road. It's a great example of, like, the streamlined modern. And it's, you know, you have to go by at night when the neon lights it up. It's just absolutely breathtaking. The Central National Bank and West Hospital are two of probably the most well-known here in Richmond. And they're both a great example of, like, the ziggurat style, which is kind of more of like a waterfall shape. It kind of comes in and tapers. I'm trying to think of what else is out there. I mean, if you go down the Grace Street Historic Corridor, there's, you know, if you just look up, there's so many wonderful places right there. I think there's so much deco in Richmond that most people don't even realize.
I guess the Hippodrome.
The Hippodrome is another one.
That's
really great.
One that just got renovated and restored.
Absolutely beautiful. If you have a chance, please go in there and look at it. I mean, they've done a wonderful job, and they really did a great job trying to restore it back to, you know, 1930s glory. So when you walk in, it really is like stepping back in time. It's absolutely beautiful. They did a wonderful job.
Well, how about the rest of Virginia? I understand there's some really good examples in Norfolk and Charlottesville.
There are. There's quite a few in Charlottesville. There's a Coca-Cola bottling building that's really beautiful. The Allied Arts Building in Lynchburg. It's very similar to the Central National Bank here, but I think it's prettier. It has these beautiful, it almost has elements of the Chrysler Building in New York. It has the big, you know, eagles on it, and it's just, oh, it's absolutely beautiful. It looks like it was plucked from Manhattan. It's just gorgeous. There's also a post office in Norfolk, I believe, that's also in the Art Deco style.
Wow.
It's really everywhere. And once you spot it, you'll just see it.
It's everywhere, but it's not all blocked together. You have to go doing a little searching.
Right,
you have to know what you're looking for.
That's right. Definitely. You do have to know. But once you see it, you'll just be like, it is.
That's Art Deco, right?
Can you name some examples of Art Deco as an influence on today's society? Are there things in our culture that still are being informed by the Art Deco style?
Yeah, I mean, Art Deco is an interesting style because it makes a resurgence every so often. Like in the 50s and 60s, we saw a resurgence. A lot of the mid-century modern furniture that you see is very influenced by Art Deco, with the streamlined legs, the tapered legs. So it's in the chrome usage. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the two designs. In the 80s, again, it made another resurgence. You'll see these, you know, I always think of these, there's like this 80s artwork of like the woman, and she's kind of, you know, angular and put together. That's very influential by Art Deco style. And, you know, even today, I just, you know, there's so many, you see furniture with the chrome and, you know, just very sleek. And you see a lot of it. It really is influential. And I think that's what's so, another aspect of it that's so alluring is that it's modern. And it's withstanding time. It's still here and still being, you know, an influential, you know, in every element and design. You're seeing it in posters. I'm seeing it in, you know, just every aspect.
You guys have some interesting events coming up, including one where you're going to go to the Virginia Museum and look at the Art Deco collection at the VMFA. Talk about how people can get involved if they want to join the Art Deco Society of Virginia. What would they have to do?
Well, the museum tour that you just mentioned is open to members and non-members alike.
Oh, okay.
And, so you can register for the...
I think y'all will be more fun to go with the
audience. That's right.
But certainly anybody can go to our website, which is artdecova.org, and register for the tour. It's on September 16th in the afternoon, and it'll be a tour that'll be led by the Deco expert at the museum.
Yes, her name's Rosaline Cosby. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, okay. She's going to take us through, and, you know, I told her we needed somebody who's going to be able to answer any question we may have. We may throw some doozies. So I'm told that she's the one who's going to be the best to answer these questions.
And, they have a pretty good collection.
Yes,
they
do. People don't know, the Virginia Museum has an excellent collection of Art Deco and Art Nouveau style pieces. So it's a fantastic collection.
Yeah, I believe outside of France, they have the largest collection.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's awesome.
We're really excited about it. It's $5 for members, $7 for non-members, and we just ask that you sign up in advance so we have, a head count. So you can do that through our website.
And certainly people can become members of the Art Deco Society of Virginia as well on our website. And there's a link for membership, and there's various membership options that you can choose from. So we welcome anybody who is interested.
Mm-hmm. Well, Olivia, you seem to be really keeping the spirit of retro alive in Richmond. You also recently entered a casting call contest to appear on the TV show Mad Men, which is set in the early 60s.
I did.
Do you sometimes feel you were born at the wrong time?
Yeah, I really do. And my mother's said that to me, since I was a child. I really do. I'd like to tell my fondest memories of growing up, is learning how to jitterbug and go-go dance with my parents in the family room. I grew up listening to 45s, and I still listen to the majority of my music on vinyl today. Mm-hmm. My house is it's a mixture of mid-century modern and art deco, and, even down to my plates are vintage. So it's just something about it. I really do think I may have been born in the wrong time. I just love it.
Well, then you may be the person to ask this very weird question.
Oh, Lord.
What is the future of retro in Richmond?
Ooh.
Andy, you may want to take a
of retro
shot at
Richmond.
That.
It's interesting because you meet more and more people that are just, enamored with different areas of history, whether it's the 20s, whether it's the 30s, a lot of 50s, you have that whole rockabilly kind of genre going on. So, I think it's just going to continue. I mean, new generations are finding this, and they're finding a new love. So I don't think it's ever going to go away. So I think it's just going to continue to evolve. And hopefully with the society, we'll, encourage more people and meet more people for that love of the 1920s and 30s to join us.
Yeah, great. I agree.
Well, we've been talking to Olivia Lloyd and Andy Nishida. They're from the Art Deco Society of Virginia. If you want more information on the society and their upcoming events, you can go to artdecova.org. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thanks for
having
us.
Thank you very much.
That's Open Source RVA for Friday, August 24, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producer is Jay Westerman, and our board op is Rachel Solomon. This and past episodes of Open Source RVA are now available to listen to anytime you want. Check out our new Open Source RVA Facebook page for a link to podcasts, as well as more information on WRIR's Audio News Digest. And we want to send a shout-out to Justin and Chris at the Cellar Door. Sadly, the Cellar Door is closed, but the memories will linger on. Thanks, guys. We'll meet you here next week for another edition of Open Source RVA.
On the golf course, I'm under par. Metro-Goldwyn have asked me to star. I've got a house, a show place. Still I can't get no place with you. Cause you're so supreme. Lyrics I write of you, I dream day and night of you. dream just for the sight of you. Baby, what good does it do? I've been consulted by Franklin D. Grandma Garbo has had me to tea. Still I'm broken hearted, 'cause I can't get started with you.